Good morning. Nice to see people. Thought it was worth getting up at 9:30 on Saturday morning. That's, I hope it will be. That's I'm Kurt Strasser. That's and I'm going to spend 20 minutes talking about an aspect of U.S. law and the implicit model of business structure that's sort of wrapped inside, not just implicit, the explicit model, and then try to talk about why that model doesn't match up very well with the business reality. And that's the first point. And the second point then is I'm going to try to persuade you that it would be better if we had a model that did match up with the business reality, which involves getting into, so what goes wrong? Where do we run into problems? This is a paper that's co-authored with my frequent co-author, Philip Blumberg. And Philip, sorry he could not be here today. Philip is 91, still writing away, but he picks his opportunities to travel somewhere. That's, okay, that's... this is my very simplified attempt to depict the structure of what a modern multinational business is put together like. This is what I suggest is the business reality. So we have here, he is very familiar with the nothing original about this. The parent corporation, I put three subsidiaries here. With a big company, you might have 50 subsidiaries, you might have 100 subsidiaries, and then you've got a bunch of second-tier subsidiaries. The example that I thought of, we could come up with literally thousands, but I thought about General Electric. All right, so here, General Electric is the parent company. And if we started thinking about, so who are the subsidiaries, because there have been a lot of subsidiaries, but ones that have been somewhat in the news lately, one of these would be GE Capital. All right, and with all the financial stuff, they got invited to the party along with all of the other financial firms. Another one which is more familiar to people with an environmental interest is GE Energy. This is the outfit that disposed of all the PCBs in the Hudson River and is now in the middle of, I guess, as big a PCB cleanup as we've ever had. But, for example, that's what these are. The point of this slide is to say the business reality is this is all one big operation. These are not really separate in any kind of real sense. It may be that the parent allocates some operating independence here, and it may not allocate operating independence here, or it may change the operating independence. I'm willing to guess, for example, that BP is going to greatly restrict the operating independence of its drilling subsidiaries. Everything I know is just what I read in the paper, but what they've learned is their drilling subsidiaries can get them into a whopping batch of trouble that they really weren't allowing for. But the point here again is, whatever level of operating independence we have down here, and we have down here, is a strategic management decision here. And it can be changed as as management perceives that the needs of the strategy. Okay. The point of all that then is the hallmarks are first, you have common control. Right? The parent company is in charge of all of it. The parent company makes the decisions. If you run a subsidiary and the president of the parent doesn't like what you're doing, you're probably not going to be running that subsidiary very long. Secondly, second most important hallmark is economic integration. Typically, this group operates in an integrated fashion. Here, I'm just going to summarize quickly, but I'll be happy to have more questions if we need to. But what I mean by that is they typically raise capital centrally, and if they don't raise capital centrally, it's a strategic decision. Typically, they move their employees around centrally, so it doesn't particularly matter which subsidiary you work for if they want you running another one. Typically, they make all sorts of business decisions centrally to then allocate the operations around to the different operating subsidiaries. Right? I'm calling all of this an enterprise. Something we'll want to spend a few minutes thinking about as we get further along is what's the outer limit of the enterprise? Right? I've given you the stereotypical easy example where the parent owns all of the subsidiaries. What about situations, and that is to say is the most typical, but what about situations in which the enterprise is formed with contracts, maybe a franchising arrangement, maybe joint ventures, things like that. And then also, what are we going to do about defining an enterprise when we get into some of the more modern investment vehicles? What about private equity funds and things like that, right? And at this point, I simply want to note, at the outer limit, we have a problem, or we have some difficult definitional points. But the fact that we have those at the outer limit doesn't detract from the reality that most of the time we're not at that outer limit, and that the law is mostly misperceiving this core reality.
Okay.
Now, in contrast to the model that I put on the board for the business reality, this is what the law sees. The law says the corporation is the important entity, and these are the investor shareholders. Now, the talk yesterday afternoon did a really good job of illuminating what are issues involved in this relationship, how do we, or do we want to be thinking about doing it. I'm bound to say that Bill did a good job of making me question what has always been the holy grail. Wait a minute, the shareholders are supposed to run everything. But that's all involved in these relationships here. This is the model that the law seeks. All right. The hallmark of this model, first, is that each corporation is a separate legal entity. So it can own property, it can sue, it can be sued in the United States, it has some constitutional rights, it's the important entity. Okay? And the second hallmark is that shareholders have limited liability. They're liable for what they've already put into the company, but that's all. So if the company is sued, BP would be a familiar example, we don't expect that the shareholders in BP will be liable for the cleanup. We expect only that the company will be. All right. And this is very traditional corporate law. Nothing controversial about this. Limited liability was set up basically around the time that this became the law was changed so that it's fairly easy to form corporations. Lots of business was done that way. A limited liability was a way of attracting investment to the companies. And the flesh out in the paper, I think I won't take the time to talk about it now, but flesh out in the paper a bit of what are the conventional rationales for this. Again, this is all well developed. It's not new. It's not controversial. Then the traditional theory is, okay, we have a limit to limited liability, and in United States law, it travels under the label of piercing the veil. British law, it's lifting the veil. There are analogous doctrines. The titles are different, but in most continental systems, there is a way of getting around limited liability, typically focusing on it being abused and also focusing on the formal nature of corporate structures not having been used. All right. So where does that... flesh out one more detail then. What that then means is that the slide I had up here showing the traditional legal model, shareholders up here and the corporation down here, that means that the law sees GE Capital as a separate corporation. And it sees GE as the shareholder of that corporation. All right. The difficulty then is that the view that the law takes of it is not an accurate representation of the business reality. Now, a fair question then is, so what? The law doesn't see the business reality, but if no problems flow out of it, do we really care? And that's where we come then to the problems that we do see. The law gives the parent company the same limited liability as the investor shareholder. GE is not liable for the cleanup liabilities of GE Energy. Now, in GE's case, I don't think this matters. I think GE Energy can afford it just fine, and in fact, we might get into bail piercing and other things. But this is the starting point for the traditional rule. And the problems with this are that the parent company is not an investor in the way we mean investor shareholders for limited liability. Rather, it's a manager. We're breaking up the enterprise artificially. The traditional justifications for limited liability don't fit here. Perhaps more important, because the business reality and the legal model don't match, legal decision makers don't see the business reality, and the legal structure is something that lawyers can rearrange very easily if there's a strategic advantage. It's been a long time since I was in practice, but my memory is that you'd form a subsidiary corporation on a slow Tuesday afternoon when there was nothing going on. It's really not very hard to do as a legal matter, so you can shuffle the structure any way you want, and what you do is then start rearranging legal rights and legal responsibilities. All right. For example, and I'm really just going to talk about one of these, I won't use too much time, but you often get, often you can get poor legal decisions in enterprise cases. And the one I want to talk about is Best Foods. This is the U.S. Supreme Court about 15 years ago. The case was concerned with cleanup of Superfund contamination. Right? And the issue was, is the parent company going to have to pay for the cleanup liability of the subsidiary? Now, obviously, this only comes up when the subsidiary is short of money. And as you can imagine, in the hands of clever counsel, it wouldn't be too hard to arrange the world this way, so that you had a subsidiary with a lot of liabilities and very few assets, and all the assets were somewhere else. Right? So that then is what we're struggling with. What the Supreme Court said was we would apply the traditional model. The parent company is an investor shareholder. And we would only hold the parent company liable if the classic piercing the veil test applied. Right? They ultimately were held not to apply there. Now, what's the problem with this? The problem with this is we're deciding Superfund cleanup liability, not looking at environmental law and environmental policy. We're deciding Superfund cleanup liability, looking at traditional notions of corporate separateness, which, by the way, don't reflect the business reality. Right? That's the kind of problem. We don't have a lot of time. I'm going to march on. Suffice it to say, it wouldn't be hard to come up with 100 examples like this if you wanted to. All right, so what we argue is we should decide limited liability with enterprise analysis. And that at first blush is a radical idea to U.S. corporate lawyers. But our second point then is it's not such a radical idea. In fact, we do a lot of enterprise analysis. We just don't call it that. And that's what the paper develops. All right. So how do we go about doing that? Well, first, you forget traditional veil piercing. All right. This is a real stumbling block for American lawyers because that piercing the veil is such a powerful metaphor. It's got a certain ring to it. The typical U.S. law student, if they don't remember anything else from corporations, they will remember that phrase, piercing the veil. All right. So first, you've got to forget that. Secondly, when you're deciding whether these are separate parts of an enterprise and should be treated separately or whether they should be treated together, consider the policy and rules of the body of law at stake. So, if it's an environmental case, think about environmental policy. Coming back to my Best Foods example, should the parent have to pay for the subsidiary's liability? Well, even if you don't do any work with environmental law, you will recognize the phrase when I say polluter pays is a critically important idea in U.S. environmental law and in European environmental law. So that ought to be our starting point here, not as the parent separate from the subsidiary, but is this the polluter we ought to make pay? And given that they're part of one enterprise, or when they're part of one enterprise, the answer to that is usually going to be yes. Obviously, you've got to look at the facts of your individual case.
All right.
And so we wind up then saying, usually you will look to the whole enterprise for rights and responsibilities. You'll do that whenever it makes sense to.
All right. I'm simply going to list. They're further developed in the paper, and I don't think there's much controversy about it. When we get around to defining what is an enterprise,
these are the things we want to look to. We mentioned common control and economic integration before, and I think these four are really subsidiary, filling in the notions of control and, these are really filling in the notions of what makes the corporate group an enterprise.
No, I thought it said end at first.
I've got a flip side.
Okay. All right. And in fact, we have a lot of examples. I'm going to put them all up here, and then I'm just going to talk about two. Again, these are developed in the papers. First, I'm going to talk about the example of securities regulation. We do in the United States and in Europe, everywhere, heavily regulates the sale of securities. What about misbehavior by an unregulated subsidiary? What about misbehavior by an unregulated parent company? Right. What if the fraud is done at that level? What if the misrepresentation is done at that level, but not by the company that's actually issuing the securities? Well, obviously, if you're going to be effective in regulating these sales and in regulating these markets, you're going to have to reach more broadly than just the individual corporation. You're going to have to reach the whole enterprise. And so it's not surprising that when we set up the structure, which is still largely the structure we have, but when we set it up in the 1930s, we said that securities regulation extends to, quote, any person directly or indirectly controlling or controlled by an issuer. Straight enterprise law. We're going to reach the whole enterprise. We're looking at common control here. And we did that not because Congress realized that 70, 80 years later, Blumberg and Strasser were going to come along with this idea, but rather we did that because that's the only way you can make securities regulation effective. Otherwise, it's so easy to get around. Let me mention an example which I didn't actually develop the law on here, but I think will be very familiar to us. If I note AIG and its problems, right, a financial company that, unless you've been living on the moon, you've heard a lot about in the last year or so, many of their problems stemmed from the behavior of a particular subsidiary, AIG Financial, located in London. According to the press reports, they wound up writing $441 billion worth of, selling $441 billion worth of credit default swaps, which are functionally a type of insurance policy. What happened here is that the potential liabilities completely swamped the rest of the company. The whole company's credit rating was downgraded, and as we all know, the bailouts followed, and the gazillions of dollars flowed out of it. This is why, if you want to be effective in, for example, financial regulation, you've got to reach the subsidiaries as well as the parents. I haven't had a chance to look it up yet, but I know they reached a deal on the new U.S. Financial regulation yesterday. And a critical question will be, if you want to stop people from trading with their own assets, if you want to limit their trading in derivatives, have you reached the subsidiaries also? Because if you haven't, you effectively can't reach them. Right. So the second example I want to mention is an example that comes from much more sort of ordinary law, from jurisdiction and procedure. In United States law, if Uri sues me, I can get a lot of discovery from Uri. I can get him to tell me everything he knows about the dispute. Does the parent company have to give discovery in a suit against the subsidiary? And the answer is, it depends on whether the information, quote, is available, unquote. The traditional rule on discovery, nothing to do with piercing the veil, nothing to do with whether the parent is a separate company or not a separate company. Once again, another example of enterprise law. All right. So where we wind up then is there are a group of common elements here. We tend to have enterprise examples where we need them to respond to the needs of a legal area, the needs at issue. Secondly, that the traditional model doesn't really get in the way very much because we don't pay much attention to it. It's interesting that we don't discuss it and reject it, we just ignore it. And more often, these are modern regulatory and tax policy issues, although not exclusively. In the paper, I develop a contracts example. The problem, then, that we still see is each of these is a specific exception. So I want to take 1 minute and try to persuade you that we need a general theory of enterprise analysis here rather than a group of specific exceptions. Now, you could well ask the question, why do we? Maybe we don't. First, I need to apologize also for the typo in this slide. I noticed it just this morning. This is what happens when you edit it the last minute. But the question should be, do we need a general theory, right? You can say perhaps we don't. We have all this legislation. Congress seems able to make an exception in the statute when they need it. We have piercing the veil. It's not a very good tool, but it's out there. We use it from time to time. I want to at least ask you to consider that these individual exceptions are not enough. It's very piecemeal, and it's very erratic. You have to have an awful lot more faith in your legislature than I do in ours to think that they're always going to make the exceptions you need. And in doing it this way, by making each one a separate exception rather than articulating a general theory, we preclude the possibility of one area learning from another. Labor law has to make up its own theory. Tax law has actually about 30 different theories that apply here. Contracts has to make up its own theory rather than one area learning from another. Secondly, with the general theory, we can counterbalance the conventional wisdom, the kind of knee-jerk response that says piercing the veil is important and all-powerful. And third, eventually, over time, I think, we would develop a body of rules applying that general theory that would give us greater predictability. So, in conclusion, I really want to just hit 3 points. First, enterprise analysis is the way to go. It's a better way to decide how to allocate rights and responsibilities within the modern business enterprise. I'm saying nothing about the liability of investor shareholders. That's the discussion for a different day. It has its own controversy. But I think it's really a different discussion looking to different important social policies. Secondly, the traditional theory, they're separate entities and piercing the veil is the way to make an exception, really doesn't work out for modern law and modern business enterprise. And third, this apparently radical idea is in fact not radical at all. We've got a lot of it running around in our system, and the walls are not falling in. Indeed, the places we have it running around, we probably think things work better as a result of that. Thank you for your time. I'll look forward to your questions after.
Because we have many examples in France, for instance, in which some subsidiaries have been created just to resolve environmental of firing employees. And when the parent companies and the subsidiary are located in two different countries, it is often very difficult for the lawyers to bring some evidence about the responsibility of the parent company. And of course, they have a strong intuition about the role played by the parent company, but they cannot succeed in bringing any evidence to prove to the commercial courts that there is a will, an industrial aim in such an organization. So in some cases, we discussed about Metal Europe in France with Yuri Pundi some minutes ago. It was the case also in the automotive industry with a big affair involving a French company, Molex, and an American group, which was a parent company. The Commerce Church did not succeed in involving the parent company because there is a competition in the legal system that prevents any connection between the both.
And probably you're going to need an EU-level rule, or dare I say it, even a larger world rule for that, because if there's a strategic advantage in being in the parent being incorporated in another jurisdiction, they will be incorporated in another jurisdiction. Thomas Hardy and its asbestos liability in Australia is a well-known example where Thomas Hardy became a Dutch company, which I guess is within the geographic world about as far away as you can go to try to escape its liability. Eventually, they were held liable, but it was as much a political decision, the special legislation, as it was a traditional legal decision. So to the extent that there's strategic advantage in breaking yourself up, traditional theories of separateness will be exploited. As I say, this is what the lawyers will do. So eventually you're going to need an enterprise doctrine that extends pretty broadly. That's There's a distinction I'd like to make here, though. I'm only talking about limited liability within the enterprise, limited liability for the parent company and the upper tier subsidiaries. The whole question of whether you should have limited liability for those investor shareholders, I think it's a rich question, and it's one we're looking at, and there's a modern justification and there's a modern controversy about it, and you know, that's a topic worth exploring. It seems to me one critical question that comes to the fore there is, do you really get more investment, and do you really get the kind of investment you want with that sort of limited liability? Right? But I'm willing to suggest that when GE decides whether to set up another subsidiary or not, they're probably not much moved by limited liability. So I would be willing to bet that that's not generating more investment within the large business enterprise, and that's really the only context we're talking about. Certainly with all the limited liability companies and that sort of stuff, there we're really looking for investor, what I'm calling investor shareholders, although they don't have shares.
Broader and saying in a closely held corporation context as well,
And that case, again, that's a battle I'm happy to take on another day, but that's a paradigm case for our traditional piercing the veil. The shareholders who actually run the company, they go in and out of the bank account, they commingle the assets, they never have board of directors meetings, they all the, and that's a, if piercing the veil does anything well, which I think is a very fair question to ask, but if it does anything well, that's the case it tries to deal with. And I guess I'm making the much more modest claim here, which is this case is different than that. That's all.
Have you used in your
eyes?
Maybe this sort of builds off the same kind of comment, but on the one hand, I sort of, the model you present, which is not a legal scholar, just makes a lot of intuitive sense that the law should sort of map onto what it is that companies actually do. But then Hardy wonders the degree to which legal frameworks not only reflect what it is that organizations are actually doing, but the way they then shape resulting corporate practice. So then, if you then sort of were to alter the system, would it just say, okay, now we've got sort of a neat meshing of law and practice, or would a new legal framework then transform how corporations and multi-holding companies actually change their practice?
And my armchair empirical answer, and that's the only kind of empirical work I do is armchair empirical work. My armchair empirical answer is I don't think so. And the gist of it would be the same thing I was saying a minute ago. Using GE as my example, I think GE chooses its structure of subsidiaries and second-tier subsidiaries and all that sort of thing pretty much for strategic management reasons. And they're not primarily making investment decisions. Those strategic management decisions will probably stay the same. If you say, so what data have you got to prove that? And the answer is, I don't. I think that where that question really gets to be important, and it's something that Lynn touched on too, is once you get outside my paradigm holding company structure, you've got contractual arrangements, you've got franchising arrangements, and other, sometimes there are other kinds of liability that run around in there. You may have fairly exotic investment arrangements. Then it seems to me you've got a difficult problem of defining what the enterprise is. And I'm not going to pretend that I have the answer to all of those. I think you're going to have to ask some core questions. Who's in control? Who's managing the enterprise? How much economic integration is there? And then spin that out in the facts. And you will have a period during which the results will be uncertain. And you'll have to live with that, and hopefully you'll work out some new rules. Let me just note in passing that the thing we're comparing it to, this is the easiest part of my argument, we're comparing it to piercing the veil. Right? We could probably fill up this room with articles that say, piercing the veil doesn't work out very well. That's so, in that sense, it's not that we've got a perfect alternative.
Okay. We're going to take the questions. I got three more. We're going to take the questions, and then you listen and wrap up.
Okay.
I've heard you give a variation on this talk before, and I appreciate it a lot. And just a note from an accounting perspective, we've had the enterprise view for 50 years, and that's the standard practice. It seems to me that you may never reach a solution within the area of corporate law, but that you might reach a solution within the area of tort law, because I think of the analogies to the Cardozo cases, like the Buick case, for example, where he went way beyond the privity of contract to say that Buick had liability for damage of its product and so forth. It seems to be the answer to holding the parent company liable.
It is just to continuous from the economic point of view. Because if you consider United Kingdom, so when you, in 1852, when you have the law about limited responsibility, so it was not applicable. But after, you have a lot of discussion between Keynes, Schaffer, and also Marshall about the economic interest of this law and about investment and control. And I think it would be very interesting to consider what they say, because in fact, they consider the industrial point of view, if it is useful or not for economic. They consider also the financial point of view, if it is good for shareholders, and also if it is good for savers. And I think it is maybe very interesting to compare and just to renew this debate today.
I would love to have a European co-author to work with on that. I often feel like I'm getting in talking about things I really don't know what I'm talking about.
Yes, if I had understood you well, you distinguish between cases where the parent company should not be liable. And these are the cases of liability towards normal creditors, banks, bondholders, and so on. And other cases where the parent company should be liable. For example, environmental law, tax law, etc. I do not see the central criterion for distinguishing. And let's now take an example. Unfortunately, I lost my mobile phone on the trip here to USA, and yesterday, because I need a mobile phone, yesterday I went to a telecom shop, to a T-Mobile shop, to buy a telephone. T-Mobile is a German telecom enterprise, and I have the expectation to be affiliated afterwards to the German telecom, which is the parent company. Should German telecom, according to your theory, be liable or not if something is wrong with my mobile phone, which I bought here at T-Mobile by USA?
Okay, that's a very good question, and I think it links up with the question here. The cases and Richard was referring to, we put under the heading of products liability. If I buy a power tool at the hardware store and it injures my hand, the store is liable, but so is the maker of the tool. Maybe the designer of the tool at the liability stems very far. Right? And indeed, that's, in my view, enterprise plus. Or maybe it's a very robust definition of enterprise that says if you're going to get a whole collection of people, including a whole collection of different business entities together, and they all contribute to putting this drill in the store and then in my hand, then they all have to bear some responsibility. We're going to call that an enterprise. And it's interesting that when we did that in U.S. law, we completely ignored the notion of piercing the veil in limited liability. We didn't talk about it and decide to reject it. We just said, oh, no, this is something entirely different. Now, this is perhaps the genius of the common law. That's sometimes we just want to change the subject. Right. So then coming to your question, what's the criteria? That's exactly the core question here. And in my view, the criteria shouldn't come from corporate law, parent and subsidiary in that relationship. The criteria should come from the underlying body of law. It should come from environmental law. In contract law, it should come from the policies of contract law. If, for example, and I developed this in the paper, if you are making a contract with the subsidiary, you know it's the subsidiary. The example I use is one in which the parent refused to give any financial information about the parent and said, we just won't make the contract. In that case, contract law says you get the deal you made. You made a deal with the subsidiary, you get the subsidiary. So the criterion is you look to the policy of the underlying body of law. You get outside the conceptual blinders, in my view, of parents and subsidiaries. And that's a perfect point for me to wrap up on, because that's the point we're trying to make. Again, thank you for your time.